Good morning. This is Wendy Bauer. I will be reading from the Decatur Herald and Review. Today is May 25th, 2015. On the cover of the paper, the lead article is Decatur Parade Steps Off to Honor America's Fallen. Wonderful picture starts the article. Two little boys riding in a red wagon. Caption under the picture, as their parents, John and Tia Rodriguez, helped carry a giant American flag, 6-month-old Owen Rodriguez and his brother Peyton, 20 months, hitch a ride. From Decatur. From sea to shining sea, Decatur Vietnam War veteran Stephen Spear told a downtown crowd Sunday that America is a country worth fighting for. The keynote speaker at a parade and ceremonies to mark both Memorial Day and the 50th anniversary of the start of the Vietnam War, Spear said he had rediscovered his nation on a 3,600-mile cross-country bicycle trip in 2014. He had set off from the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., clutching the names of 9 fallen comrades taken in etchings from the wall. He said he needed to remember and honor them and take a close look at the country they had died for. Spear, 67, said he met a long succession of warm and kind-hearted people who proved his friends' lives had not been given in vain. "Our greatest gift as Americans are the fine people we have in our country," he added. Dozens of those people in police, fire, and military uniforms, active and retired, had earlier paraded through downtown on their way to Central Park. They were joined by civilian groups ranging from Elks clubs to volunteers and dogs from the Homeward Bound pet shelter, marching with each other in a snaking procession that featured more than 40 different organizations. The Central Park ceremonies began at noon with patriotic music and songs by the Decatur Municipal Band and the Greater Decatur Chorale. The weather forecast had warned of a possible frontal assault by storms that organizers feared had kept the audience numbers light, but the rain surrendered the day with only a few scattered drops. "I think the weather scared a lot of people," said Kevin Brahini, president of J.L. Hubbard Insurance and Bonds, who co-sponsored the event, along with an Ameren, Illinois military veteran employees group. "But it's turned out to be very pleasant, and boy, look at that parade. What great participation." Marching at the front of the parade was the Macon County Honor Guard, and barking orders to them was former Illinois Army National Guard soldier Michael Hiller from Harristown. His old dress uniform was still fitting like a glove. Hiller had been in charge of training soldiers statewide for services at military funerals and attended up to 500 of them a year. "I'm proud of my service, and I've always taken pride in the military itself," said Hiller, 37, who has been a civilian since 2013. "I love everything the military stands for." In a related article, captioned "Decatur, Birthplace of Memorial Day," Tony Reed and the Herald and Review staff, who is a Herald and Review staff writer, writes from Decatur, "The mystic chords of memory that swelled into the chorus of remembrance we call Memorial Day had its first notes sounded in Decatur. It all began with the Grand Army of the Republic, which called for the creation of Decoration Day in 1868, a commemoration that would eventually morph into the Memorial Day we honor today." So the GAR gave us Memorial Day, and a march back through history shows Decatur gave us the GAR. The Veterans Organization for Union Soldiers who served in the Civil War was actually the brainchild of Major Benjamin F. Stevenson, who lived in Springfield. His idea was to create something that could pool resources and help the hungry and poor widows and orphans left behind by his fellow soldiers killed in the war. He also thought it would be jolly to have something to promote worthy comradeship between the survivors who had lived to go home again. Strangely, Stevenson also planned for the organization to be hush-hush, with secret ritual, a kind of uniformed masons with ceremonial muskets. According to Decatur Herald archives, he needed a printer to print up the ritual rules, but wanted the printers to be veterans, so everything would stay on a need-to-know basis. He could find no eligible printers in Springfield where he lived, but former comrades informed him that there were two veterans living in Decatur who were engaged in the printing trade. The paper reported a look-back piece about this in 1915. Stevenson found his printers, and they became so enthused with the idea, they prevailed upon the major to found the Grand Army of the Republic, here in Decatur, the paper writes. So the GAR was officially mustered into being April 6, 1866, with post number 1 establishing its first meeting place at what was then 253 South Park Street, next to Central Park. The secret ritual bit was dropped along the way as the GAR's numbers began to swell. Hundreds of members would eventually join the Decatur Post, and the GAR's national ranks had expanded to 445,000 by 1892. With growth came publicity, and with publicity came political firepower and influence, which was being felt as early as 1868. That's when the GAR's second commander-in-chief, Major General John A. Logan, issued something called General Order No. 11, establishing May 30th as Decoration Day to honor Union veterans' graves, and it wasn't long before a grateful nation also snapped to attention and took notice of what the GAR was doing. The idea of soldier grave decorating dated back to the war itself and sprang from women in the Confederacy who, in 1863, and just a year after the bloody Battle of Shiloh, had gone around scattering flowers on rebel war graves. But in an act of compassion, they were moved by the sight of unkempt graves for some Union soldiers, and they scattered flowers on those too. It was a mark of healing respect, the story of which traveled rapidly by word of mouth. May 30th was the date Logan picked for Decoration Day because he knew spring flowers would be in bloom across the country by then. His orders told the GAR posts nationwide to decorate the veterans' graves and always safeguard them at all costs. Let no neglect, no ravages of time testify to the present or to the coming generations that we have forgotten as a people the cost of a free and undivided republic, the general's order said. Over time, the passion behind Decoration Day grew, and veterans and families wanted to remember the soldiers of other wars, too. After World War I, the Decoration Day ceremonies were expanded to include all who have died in the service of their nation, and in 1971, what was described as Memorial Day was declared a national holiday by an act of Congress and shifted to the last Monday in May. As the numbers of veterans grew across time, time's ultimate roll call had been busy thinning the ranks of the GAR. The last surviving member of the Decatur Post, C.H. Collins, died in 1942. Albert Wilson of Duluth, Minnesota, the last Union veteran nationwide, died at the age of 109 in 1956. He had been a drummer boy and is now honored with the statue at Gettysburg. The GAR's memory marches on, however. The torch of remembrance, now held aloft by the Sons of Union Veterans of the Civil War, founded in 1881. Membership is open to those who can claim ancestral links to a Civil War soldier, and associate membership is also open to those who just like the cause. Dana Hales of Newman belongs to the 24-strong Franklin Reed Post No. 24 in Tuscola and can claim a direct link. His great-grandfather, William F. Mavity, was a corporal in Company K of the 125th Illinois. He survived the war, but not all of him, says Hales, 65. He lost an arm because of a wound and amputation in September 1864. Mavity came home to struggle on as a disabled farmer and received the princely sum of $24 a month pension in compensation for his missing arm. He died in 1893 at the age of 58, Hale says. My grandmother was still collecting the pension when she died in 1955. Hales says members of the Sons of Union veterans visit schools and other organizations to give Civil War talks and share the story of the brother-against-brother conflict that shaped this nation. The Civil War has so much meaning, Hales says, but on Memorial Day, we also remember all those men and women in uniform who made the ultimate sacrifice of losing their life. And we remember all those who provided their services to their country for a period of time and have since passed away. In Decatur and Macon County, the death of soldiers, young and old, is honored by the Macon County Honor Guard, veterans who perform graveside military ritual and fire rifle salutes. Since the Honor Guard was formed in 1995 by its current commander, 87-year-old Rudy Escobar of Decatur, it has carried out 3,358 funerals, traveled 94,000 miles, and fired more than 70,000 blank rounds. We don't only do it for the deceased, we do it for the family, to let them know there is somebody else who has not been forgotten, he says. The Honor Guard never stands at ease for long. Escobar says their weekly average of veterans' funerals ranges from a minimum of one to a maximum of six. Every day for us is Memorial Day, he says. In an article by Teresa Churchill, a Herald and Review senior writer, we learn that Milliken is to add a nuclear science program. The article also notes that for more information about Milliken University's clinical nuclear science program, one can email David Horn or call at 217-424-6392. His email address is dhorn@milliken.edu. From Decatur. Milliken University, in partnership with Decatur Memorial Hospital and ZivaCor Molecular, will add an undergraduate clinical nuclear science program this fall. David Horn, associate professor of biology, said the program will give upper-level biology, chemistry, and physics majors another pathway to careers in diagnostic imaging, pharmacology, radiation safety, and regulatory work, and more. Milliken students will gain a wide range of experiences, from the production of nuclear isotopes to examining their use in diagnosing patients, Horn said. They'll get those experiences during practicums and internships at Decatur Memorial Hospital and also during a research fellowship that will let one student spend the summer of 2016 at ZivaCor's base in Noblesville, Indiana. Horn said the hope is to enroll 10 juniors and seniors in a new course called Clinical Nuclear Science 1, with a focus on physics and chemistry this fall, and move those same students on to Clinical Nuclear Science 2, with a focus on biology in the spring. ZivaCor will provide a $3,000 stipend and a $2,000 housing allowance to its research fellow next summer, and DMH will provide an identical stipend and Milliken the housing for another student to serve as the hospital's research fellow. With Illinois Health and Science as the parent company of the hospital and ZivaCor, Horn said he looks forward to expanding the performance learning opportunities the program can provide. In an article written by Ryan Voiles, a Herald and Review staff writer, police are investigating the homicide of a 42-year-old on West King Street. Decatur police are investigating the homicide of a 42-year-old man in the 700 block of West King Street. Officers responded to the area at 12:30 a.m. Saturday after a report of shots fired in the area, where they found a man later identified as Paul E. Robinson of Decatur on the front porch of a residence with multiple gunshot wounds to his extremities and torso. Robinson was taken to Decatur Memorial Hospital in critical condition and was pronounced dead at 1:23 a.m. An autopsy, completed Saturday afternoon at the McLean County Morgue in Bloomington, noted the cause of death as massive hemorrhage. Detectives continue to investigate the shooting, and anyone with information is urged to call the Decatur Police Department at 217-424-2711 or Crime Stoppers at 423-TIPS. It is the second homicide in Decatur this year. An article from Normal, written by Lenore Sabota, who is a Lee News Service writer, ISU team to address campus climate. From Normal, Illinois State University is putting together a team to address instances of bias or harassment, such as the racially charged post on Twitter that triggered a rally on campus earlier this month that attracted nearly 800 people. Art Munin, Illinois State Assistant Vice President and Dean of Students, said the idea was in the works months before the Twitter incident, which involved a Twitter account that included Illinois State in its name and posted pictures of students, but was not affiliated with the university. However, that incident is an example of the kind of thing the new group, to be known as the Campus Climate Team, is intended to target. Brent Patterson, Interim Vice President for Student Affairs, said the university wants to be sure students who feel there's a problem with the climate at the university or run into situations where they feel discriminated against or harassed have somewhere they could go to talk about it. 8 of the 10 people from across campus who are organizing the Campus Climate Team had their first meeting last week. The team is patterned after similar programs at other universities that are called bias response teams, Munin said, adding, "I never really liked the name because it is solely reactive." Illinois State's team is intended to be more proactive, not only responding to instances of bias, but also addressing the atmosphere or climate on campus related to racial, gender, religious, or other identity-related issues. The idea is to meet throughout the year, not only to respond to issues, but also keep an eye on the trends, Munin said. Patterson, who initiated the idea at Illinois State, said, "It fits in with our core values of diversity and our core value of civic engagement." Tentative plans call for developing a website and an online reporting system for instances of discrimination, harassment, or microaggressions. The latter is a term developed by psychologists that covers a broad range of slights, snubs, or insults, intentional or unintentional, aimed at marginalized groups, according to an article in Psychology Today. "It's really important to have all the information that enables us to identify patterns," Munin said. "Putting one report together with 4 or 5 others could allow me to connect the dots," he said. Although the team will be coordinated by the student affairs area, it includes representatives from across campus, including the provost's office, campus police, and the Student Government Association. Patterson said having the team overseen by the dean of students will make students more comfortable about coming forward so they can learn their options and what the process is. "We always want students who come to ISU to be successful," Patterson said. "This is just another aspect of that." The organizing group will continue meeting over the summer with the goal of having the program in place when the fall semester begins, Munin said. In an article written by Donette Beckett, a Herald and Review staff writer, article entitled "Pastor to Retire from Pulpit, Not from Preaching." A picture heads the article, and the caption is, "Brother Mayo Towles is retiring from his longtime ministry position at Jasper Street Church of Christ at the end of May. Towles and his wife, Maddie, have been married for 62 years. It's a picture of Brother Towles and his wife standing in the pulpit of their church. "Those working in church have a common saying, you go where God sends you. and if God wants you to stay in one location, you stay there. In 1968, Brother Mayo Towles began his ministry at the Jasper Street Church of Christ. "I came here to stay," he said. "I made my mind up when I felt like the Lord sent me here." Almost 47 years later, Towles has decided to retire as the church's senior minister. The congregation will be honoring him at the end of the month with a special party. But since he made his decision known, members of his congregation have been reminding him of the words he often says to them, "You never retire on the Lord." "He's retiring from the pulpit," said Lillian Cannell, the church's Bible school teacher, "but he's still active within the church and the community." Cannell and other teachers have spoken to their preacher in the past whenever they got tired of their classes and want to rotate out or retire. "He says, 'You retire when you get to heaven,'" Cannell said. "But for now," Towles is ready to travel again. During his many years in the ministry, Towles has been asked to visit other churches throughout the country. "We did gospel meetings, what some people call revivals, all over the country," he said, "from New York, California, and all in between." When he first began his travels, Towles would conduct 1 or 2 weeks of meetings. "I would hold a meeting for 2 weeks in this place, then I would have another one over here for 1 week or 2 weeks," he said. "Sometimes it would be a month or 6 weeks of constant preaching." During those times away from home, Towles and his wife Maddie made many friends from different backgrounds and places. And while the family was treated well throughout their travels, the minister said, he did compare areas of the country to the weather. "The warmer the weather, the warmer the people," he said. The church was invited more than 400, or has invited more than 400 people to Towles' retirement party on May 30th. "We are bringing in his favorite ministers to speak," Cannell said, "and he will be roasted." The church began the transition less than a year ago when the new minister, Douglas Perry, arrived from Texas. "Brother Towles felt it was time to pass the goblet," Cannell said. Although he was taking over an important position, Perry has been accepted by the congregation. During his time at Jasper Street Church of Christ, he has baptized more than 30 people. "He won our hearts," Cannell said. "He's on fire." After a Florida vacation, Towles plans to serve with the new minister at the church he calls home. "Whatever he wants me to do," Towles said. And from the editorial page, "The Crazy Way We Treat the Mentally Ill." A Bronx man died in police custody last week after police responded to a 9/11 call. An Iraq combat veteran in El Paso, Texas, serving a 2-day DWI sentence, died after being subdued by guards. A woman died after being tasered by sheriff's deputies in Fairfax, Virginia. What they had in common, besides expiring abruptly while in the hands of law enforcement officers, is mental illness. Dennis Reyes was afflicted by bipolar disorder. James Brown reported being diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Natasha McKenna had a history of schizophrenia. We used to warehouse the mentally ill in overcrowded, unsafe asylums, loony bins, where they often got crude or ineffective treatment, if any, and endured violent abuse. But our civilization has moved past that primitive stage. Now we warehouse them in jails and prisons, where their conditions are often even worse. It may seem odd that the new executive director of the Cook County Jail, Nika Jones, is a clinical psychologist, not a career cop or corrections official. It makes more sense when you consider that nearly a quarter of the inmates have mental illnesses. Sheriff Tom Dart refers to the facility as the nation's biggest mental institution, but he's got nothing on Illinois prisons, which house 6 times as many mentally ill inmates as the jail. The numbers will only get bigger. One of the grim consequences of Illinois' fiscal insolvency is Governor Bruce Rauner's proposal for a 15% cut in funding for the state's mental health agency, which pays for treatment, housing, and other services to help those with psychiatric disorders function in society. Last month, Dart told the Chicago Tribune he sees this approach as a mistake. "It doesn't make sense to cut service that prevents people from coming into the criminal justice system, which is a very expensive system to come into." Cost aside, it creates hazards for them as well as corrections officers. A new study by Human Rights Watch says persons with schizophrenia may experience prison as a particularly frightening, threatening environment, and as a consequence, some behave dangerously toward themselves, staff, or other prisoners. Many, it says, refuse to follow orders because hallucinations and delusions have impaired their connection with reality. The mentally ill violate the rules far more often than other inmates, for obvious reasons, and efforts to control them often aggravate their insanity. Some, like the prisoners cited above, end up injured or dead. Short-term budget needs sometimes take priority over long-term cost-effectiveness. But it's clear that governments need to improve their policies towards citizens who have lost their hold on sanity. One reason so many of these people wind up incarcerated is the lack of other places to put them. A 2010 report by the Treatment Advocacy Center noted, in 1955 there was one psychiatric bed for every 300 Americans. By 2005, there was just one psychiatric bed for every 3,000 Americans. Another cause is a shortage of good outpatient care. The idea behind the deinstitutionalization of the 1950s and 60s was that the mentally ill could be helped more humanely while living and being treated in community settings. But many of those released from asylums never got the help they needed. The results were disastrous, and not just for them. In his book, The Insanity Offense, psychiatrist Fuller Torrey notes that a study of 81 cities found a direct correlation between the decrease in the number of psychiatric beds and the subsequent increase in homelessness, arrest rates, and crime rates among mentally ill individuals in those cities. Sally Saifel, a psychiatrist and scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, says one remedy is to expand mental health courts, diverting some criminal offenders to non-punitive programs involving medication, treatment, and monitoring. Another, she says, is for the state and local governments to be more active in the use of mandatory outpatient treatment for mentally ill people who repeatedly end up in jail, emergency rooms, or homeless because they can't care for themselves or make rational decisions. Such measures will require funding. We're not putting enough into the people who are the most sick, Saitel told me. But there is no way for any of us to escape the social and fiscal costs of serious mental illness. We're putting a lot into these people, but in all the wrong places. Jails, prisons, and even morgues. Addressing mental illness differently would be a welcome symptom of sanity. We will now take a short break and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review on May 25th, 2015. Please stay tuned.